This is the first tape for the morning of October the 7th, the President, Noyes and Hillman present. Now, Mr. President, you wanted to go on further about the philosophy of government to follow on what you said yesterday on
yes,
the 6th.
That's right. We want to follow up the program which we had in view at that time.
May I just inject a direct question here about government. We were talking about government, the Constitution, the intent of the Constitution, and the foresight of the Constitution. But mostly, we would like to hear from you, Mr. President, how you feel Washington and Jefferson differed in their views of the function of government under the Constitution.
Well, there was not any really serious difference between Washington and Jefferson on the republic which they had helped to set up, although Washington was of the school of thought that there were certain people in existence at that time who were better fitted to run the government than were the ordinary run of people. Jefferson didn't believe that. He believed that if the ordinary people were properly educated in what they had and what they had to do to keep it, that eventually they would be as well qualified to run the government as would the aristocrats. That was the main difference between Washington and Jefferson, I think.
Now, Jefferson believed in a classless society, and Washington more or less subscribed to a class.
Well, I wouldn't say that either one of them were that far along. They were both interested in the republic which they had set up. They were both interested in, each one of them was interested in a different idea. One of them thought that the governing class ought to be educationally better off, financially better off, and with more approach to their own welfare and special interests than those whom they were exploiting, let's put it that way. Jefferson believed that the exploited part of the population could be educated to the point where they would know just as much about how to run a republic as those who thought they knew more than anybody else. I think that's the main difference.
Well, now, did either of those men take any steps in the direction of providing either better education or more of better economic opportunities for the masses, for the people, in order for them to achieve the spirit of the constitutional?
Well, at that time, educational institutions were institutions where the people who attended them were backed by enough funds to take them through the schools. It was a long time before the public schools were established to the point where the ordinary person had access to ABCs and arithmetic and writing, or the three R's. And when that time came, which was 50 or 100 years after the Constitution was set up, then the ordinary fellow had a chance at education, same as the fellow with a lot of money had. And then was the time which developed the idea that the ordinary man had just as much right and had just as much education, so far as government was concerned, as those who had special privilege in wealth and education. And that's the difference, main difference between those two parties at the beginning of the republic. And I'm of the opinion that situation has developed to the point where the general run of the population is educated to the point where they understand government. And when issues are properly put to them, they hardly ever make a mistake in deciding the operators of the government, which are the heads of it, from the president on down to the governors and the legislators and things of that sort. And I'm not at all worried about the welfare of the United States from its interior situation. The thing that really worries the people of the United States is not the domestic situation, it's the foreign situation. And when the foreign situation has developed to the point where strong dictatorships can decide what ought to go on in the world, then we will be in the same position we were when France and England, back in the 1860s and 70s, were in control of the world. We don't want to go back to that point. We want to go forward and probably educate those people who are under the totalitarian states on what free government means. I think that's what we're trying to do.
Well, Mr. President, you talk about when the people know the facts, they'll be able to decide. Are you eliminating any thought there that people will also decide on what their specific interests are, what their economic interests are, what their social interests are?
Well, of course, that always happens. But you find people with economic interests that when the facts are known and that when they understand what really is in contemplation, they'll do the right thing. I was just reading an article this morning about a young man, 30 years old, who had by chance obtained $80,000 in a pool in England. And he studied the situation, talked it over with his wife, talked it over with his religious advisors and with his financial advisors, and decided that he had obtained that $80,000 not by working in his own interest, but that he had obtained it by chance. You know what he did? He set up a program, a trust, to see that that $80,000 that he won went to the charitable education of people who were in the same class with him. Now, that shows what can be done when the proper background is in a man's head.
Well, frequently when you talk, Mr. President, about the farmers' interests and when you talk about the interests of Wall Street, you are emphasizing economic interests who seem to be guided mainly by their own interests rather than the welfare of everyone.
Well, that's absolutely true. That goes on all the time. But the objective of a fair government and a government such as we have is to see that the balance between the special interests is maintained so that they all have justice. That's all there is to it.
Is it fair to state then that the Constitution as originally conceived was not intended to be a document for the privileged?
It was not. It was not intended to be a document for the privileged. If you read the preamble of the Constitution of the United States, you find that that's exactly what it says. It's for the welfare and benefit of all the people.
Now then, to get back to the two men, Washington then was more the realist, and in your judgment, would you then classify Jefferson as the idealist?
I would. Washington was more of the realist, but Jefferson was an idealist with realistic principles. He knew the practical approach to these things and knew how, I think, better than anybody of his time, how to put them into effect.
In that sense, then, you would define him or describe him as the first and perhaps the last of the great combinations of idealist and realist of our president.
Yes, previous to the war between the states, I think that's true. After that period, we have had several of the great men. In fact, Grover Cleveland, in his first term, reestablished the prerogatives of the president, which had gone by the board between 1860 and 1884 when he was elected president. And then after that, we had Theodore Roosevelt and Franklin Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, who were had the same ideal approach to our republic that Jefferson had.
Now, how did Washington contemplate the presidency, or how did he feel about the presidency, and how did Jefferson feel about the role of the president?
Well, I think Washington's ideal, when he became president of the United States, was to put into effect the Constitution which he had helped to write. And due to his experience in the Continental Congress, he wanted to set up a government that would work for the benefit of all those people under it and not have a situation develop as had developed under King George III, which caused the oppression of people by military occupation of homes and things of that sort. And his idea was to set up a government that would work, which he did. And then Jefferson continued that idea of Washington in taking advantage of the situation that the great mass of the people were not educated and that they ought to be. And that's what he fought for principally, to have every person under that republic have an understanding of what that republic meant, and then let him use his own judgment on what kind of a government he wanted.
Of course, Washington was faced with a very realistic problem right from the very beginning when he was faced with this whiskey rebellion. People didn't want to pay taxes on...
That was one of the approaches that Washington made to set up a government that had worked. If special interests, such as the whiskey manufacturers in Pennsylvania, didn't have to pay taxes, why should anybody else do it? Washington wanted to see that everybody paid his proper tax. When the Congress of the United States decided that the whiskey ought to be taxed, Washington collected it under the law, as an executive ought to. And that kept the republic running.
Well, some of the states kept continually a certain pressure on the federal government to test its ability to govern United States.
Yes, they always did that. They've done it down to the present day. There isn't any change much.
Now, if I may jump, as we did yesterday, about 150 years again, as president, you had to do certain things and you had to inaugurate certain programs that were totally without precedent so far as all of your predecessors were concerned. Where did you draw upon for that kind of decision?
Well, I was interested in what Jefferson had done with regard to the purchase of Louisiana, and with what Washington had done in establishing the government when he made the people in the northeast part of the country and in Pennsylvania understand that the federal government had the power to enforce its rules. And then we had the same situation with which Woodrow Wilson was faced when he tried to put the League of Nations into effect. And after studying those programs, and studying the approach that Franklin Roosevelt had made with his bipartisan foreign policy, then we went on from there, and all the decisions that it was necessary for me to make were made with the idea of maintaining a world approach to the situation which the federal government of the United States was faced when they were 13 colonies became the United States. Almost the same program had to be met. And the reason it had to be met was because we had the same situation with regard to the communists trying to dominate the world that we had with Napoleon and England at the time the colonies were organized, each trying to dominate the world. We had only one program to deal with, while Washington, Jefferson, and Jackson, all those great presidents in between the organization of the republic and the war between the states, had to face with two governments. Our government had become one of the two great governments in the world, and we had to meet the other great government in the world by keeping that government from overturning a Republican form of government. That is, with regard to a republic, not the Republican Party.
Well, you were not only involved and engaged in carrying through the commitments of your immediate predecessor and the total commitments of all of your predecessors, but you were also undertaking enormous new commitments for the people of the United States.
Well, approach was gradual. Wilson was way ahead of his time in his attempt to organize the United Nations, as was King Henry IV in his grand plan for peace in Europe. And we had to approach the situation in such a way that we could hope that the Association of Nations could maintain the peace of the world on the same basis that the Constitution had created with the 13 colonies.
This is the end of take number one, the morning of October the 7th. This is take number two, the morning of October the 7th. Shall we go on, Mr. President?
Without waiving our rights to return to Madison, to Washington and Jefferson, can we go on to Madison now?
Yes, go ahead. Go right ahead.
What is your judgment of Madison's term as president in terms of accomplishment?
Well, Madison's term as president was an unfortunate one. He was the president when the War of 1812 came on, a war which the British had fought to make it proper for them to control the seas, even if they had to prevent the American merchants from being a party to a trade of the world. And when Madison was the reporter for the Constitutional Convention, he was a wonderful man, and he was had a brilliant mind. And his history and records of the Constitutional Convention are the basis on which we understand how the Constitutional Convention worked. But when he became president, he was like every other man of considerable brain power and education. He found it difficult to make decisions. And the War of 1812 was most disastrous for the United States of America. The Capitol was burned, and the White House was burned, and Madison had to flee, and Mrs. Madison, Dolly Madison, had to be sure that the pictures of Washington and Martha Washington, which were part of the decoration of the East Room of the White House, were saved. But as a president, Madison was what we might call in these days a weak sister. He couldn't make decisions.
Why was his era called the era of good feeling?
It wasn't. It was Monroe's era that was called the era of good feeling.
Madison was incapable of being decisive. Is that right, sir?
That's the whole point. And then he was in this position. We'd never developed a military force in the country that was of any consequence. And he was harassed with generals who didn't know what to do or how to do it. And he was also harassed with a militia that didn't want to fight and that was willing to surrender. He wasn't entirely to blame for that situation, because that had been a development of the program which had brought about the isolation of the government of the United States from the rest of the world. They didn't think they'd ever be invaded, they'd ever had to, would have to defend themselves. And so when the time came, they had no military minds trained to meet the situation. It wasn't altogether Madison's fault.
But then it was a lack of leadership on his part.
It was a lack of leadership and a lack of an inability to find the leaders for the military.
Is it perhaps that he was over-intellectual? Would you call him as an intellectual president?
Well, I don't know whether we want to blame the intellectuals for the fact that Madison wasn't a good president, but he was one of the intellectuals.
I see, where he studied Hebrew at Princeton.
Yes. Well, he was. He was a very well-informed man on history and government. But when it came time for him to act as an executive, he was like a great many other people. When the time comes to make decisions, they have difficulty doing.
Well, now, there were a lot of wars with the Indians in those days, a lot of Indian problems that General Harrison had to...
That was where the Battle of Tippecanoe took place, when Harrison... I think it was Pontiac, and what was the other great Indian's name? Tecumseh.
Tecumseh, yeah.
That's right. Were fighting for the welfare of their own people. And of course, with the superior weapons and superior organizations, they were defeated. And that's where Harrison got his reputation. And where John Tyler was nominated to offset the Democratic part of the ticket, and the ticket was called Tippecanoe and Tyler, too. They worked on the log cabin on a hard cider basis because somebody had come across with a statement that all Harrison and Tyler knew was hard cider and log cabin. And neither one of them ever lived in a log cabin. They were both rich men, and I don't think either one of them ever drank hard cider. I think they drank bourbon whiskey.
Well, Mr. President, to get a little bit of the background of the period in which Madison was president, after all, he took this unfortunate step, or a step which turned out to be unfortunate, but wasn't one of the great breaks that he had, or this country had, was the fact that Britain and Napoleon and France were in bitter conflict, so that Britain couldn't pay as much attention to fighting the war against us.
Oh, yes, no question about that. And, of course, when the War of 1812 came along, and they were at the end of the Napoleonic period, and the British were like every other free country. They didn't want to fight anymore. And they sent Hessians or mercenaries over to fight the War of 1812. The British themselves, I don't think, as Englishmen, took a serious hand in the situation. But they were tired, as well as all the rest of the world was, of the continued wars that had been carried on by Napoleon in Britain previous to that time.
Well, I
think that's the end of it.
Yes, but in other words, the international events that played a great role in what was happening to this country, irrespective of what the president decided.
There isn't any question about that, and the British didn't feel like coming over and trying to reconquer the colonies that had won their freedom. If it hadn't been for the Napoleonic Wars, they probably would have taken us over, because they were perfectly capable of doing it.
Well, is there any indication in anything that you've read of Madison that he was aware of that situation when he went into this defense of freedom of the seas?
I don't think he was completely aware of the fact, although he had convictions on the subject, and that's what brought about the War of 1812.
Well, he is charged with having declared that war, that he took the initiative in declaring war on Britain, did he not?
I think he did, but I think he was forced into it by the Congress with which he had to work.
I see, because it was plagued with the tag of Madison's War.
Oh, well, they do that every time. I don't think it was Madison's War anymore. It was all the rest of the country. They all wanted to fight the British on account of the commercial situation with which they were faced. The British had control of the seas, and they were impressing our seamen and doing everything of the kind like that. And they also had some idea that maybe they could conquer Canada and make it a part of the United States. Of course, they couldn't.
That war was a standoff. We licked them in the Great Lakes, did we not? And they stopped us in Canada.
That's right. And as a standoff, things were left just as they were before when the treaty was signed.
Now, there's one place in which Madison did make a very important decision. He broke with tradition. So far as a president's attire was concerned, he was the first president to give up the knee trousers and to have his suit all made in this country. Whereas up to his time, they were imported.
That's right, and they all wore silver buckle shoes and long stockings and knee breeches. That is, the officials did, the common people did.
This was part of the carryover from the colonial days.
That's right.
What is your view of men of in this new world still being the victims of the European? They gave up all European ideas, but they wore their clothes. How do you feel about a president in knee breeches?
Well, it wouldn't work in this day and age. They'd laugh him out of office.
Do you have any idea as to why Madison felt compelled to give that up?
Well, because everybody else was, the people who had the votes were wearing the same, substantially the same sort of clothes we were wearing now. Madison felt there wasn't any use following the British custom as long as we had been free up to the time when he was president.
So we were breaking away in every sense from
that's right,
from the old customs. And why with his mediocre record would you say that he waited another 4 years in the White House?
It had become at that time a matter of custom. And you find that every one of the first line of presidents, all the way up to the seventh president, were elected the second time because it's customary. Everyone except Adams. You see, Washington and Jefferson and Madison and Monroe and then the two Adamses missed out on the two-term period, and then Jackson was elected twice because Jackson was a strong president. And then after Jackson, we had a whole row of one-term presidents all the way up to the Civil War.
I think that it intrigues me about the development which almost followed out of the war as well as during the War of 1812 was the refusal of some of the New England states to either contribute to militia or to contribute any help at all to the war, despite the fact that the war was supposed to be fought to protect the maritime interests of New England.
Well, that's absolutely true. One of the main difficulties of that war was the fact that the president didn't have the support that he should have had in order to win it. And New England, of course, was about ready to secede at that time, if you remember.
Yes, that's a question I want to raise. They were really then the state writers, the people who insisted on the rights of the states.
It wasn't so much a state right as the fact that they didn't want to fight. And not only was that the case, but they wanted to save their property without doing anything about it.
In other words, a good deal of their reluctance to fight was in order to protect their property.
Well, they thought to protect their property. If they didn't fall out with the British, they thought maybe they wouldn't be taken over if the British won the war. And of course they weren't, but then that wasn't the reason. The only reason the British didn't take us over was because they didn't have the strength to do it at that time.
Or the inclination.
They were tired. They didn't want to fight anymore, and they had to use mercenaries.
Yet Madison was actually exposed to gunfire himself. He took active charge of some of the battles.
Yes, he did. He was not a coward by any means.
And he was, in that sense, the first and only commander-in-chief who ever acted in his own right as commander-in-chief in actual battle.
I think he's the only one that ever took the field. And he did that under the emergency because his generals weren't any good. He had to.
Could you recall some of his troubles with the generals? Because we...
Well, first one in charge of the colonial troops, I think, north of Washington, just backed up and laid down. That's when Madison and Dolley had to leave the White House in a hurry to keep from being captured. And had the same trouble with the generals who were supposed to go into Canada and take charge of things. They fell down. And the main difficulty was, in that period, for some reason or other, there was a great lack of military leadership. On the sea, it was different. They had several naval victories on the sea, but they were individual. Naval victories were individual victories by great commanders of individual ships. They had no organization of the Navy at that time at all.
Of course, there was General Jackson, who won the Battle of New Orleans after the war was over.
Well, you see, General Jackson had had all sorts of experience in his taking over of Florida and handling the Cherokee Indians in that part of the world. And then he was a man who was aggressive. And the militia and the men who were organized to fight the Battle of New Orleans were men who were what you might call the squirrel hunters. They liked to fight. Didn't fight anybody else. They liked to fight among themselves. So Jackson organized the Battle of New Orleans as a great general should. He put up his defenses. In fact, he used cotton bales for defense. And when the British landed, all he had to do was to slaughter them as they came ashore.
This is the end of tape 2, morning of October 7th.